This episode sponsored by She's Birdie. You lock the hotel room door, then check it again, and maybe one more time, because even the nicest room can feel unfamiliar at night. That's why She's Birdie created Birdie Box. With She's Birdie, you can bring peace of mind with you. Birdie Box is a portable travel door alarm for hotels, dorms, Airbnbs, and anywhere you stay away from home. Just attach it to the doorframe, switch it on, and if someone opens the door, Birdie Box blasts a loud siren and flashing alarm to alert you and everyone nearby. Because the best part of travel isn't worrying, it's sleeping soundly. Birdie Box from She's Birdie. Locking in peace of mind wherever you stay. For safer, more confident travel, visit she'sbirdie.com. That's S-H-E-S-B-I-R-D-I-E.com. The most important back-to-school essential for your college girl is the one no one's talking about. And right now, at She's Birdie, it's buy two, get one free. The packing lists are full of shower caddies and mattress toppers, but they leave off the one thing built to help her stay safe walking across campus after dark. It's Birdie 3.0, a rechargeable personal safety alarm small enough to live on her keychain or backpack and cute enough to carry anywhere. One pull of the top pin activates a 130-decibel siren that brings all eyes on her. No aiming, no buttons, no training. Just one instinctive pull, even with shaking hands. A dedicated on-off switch means it's always ready, but never going off between classes. Head to she'sbirdie.com and stock up for everyone heading back to school with our limited-time buy two, get one free sale. That's S-H-E-S-B-I-R-D-I-E.com. What you believe might not be. Step into the zone of the best unknown. UFOs, aliens, ghosts, Bigfoot, conspiracies and cover-ups. And to the paranormal we go with Jeremy Scott. One hit.
From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I am Jeremy Scott, and it's one of those topics tonight that fits right in with this season. Tonight, the dead live again. We're talking about vampires. I'm so looking forward to it. Now, you know, the term, the word vampires, what does that conjure up with you? When someone says vampire, for the most of us, blood sucking, blood stained fangs, an aversion to sunlight. Of course, bats go along with that. The smell of garlic, wooden stakes. Those are just a few things. But for the most part, these are creatures of the night, blood sucking creatures, right? Undead immortals. Not only do these undead immortals haunt our favorite books and television shows and movies as they've done for decades, they could be walking among our streets. Have you ever thought about what the saying dead of night means? Dead of night means the stillest and the darkest part of the evening. Seemingly where anybody out at that hour is up to no good. And so at that hour, the dead of night is when these creatures roam, supposedly. There's actually vampire violence as we should expect in the new Blade, because, of course, Blade, the original Blade, and now Blade 2. If you haven't seen Fright Night, I won't spoil it for you. All I'll just say is, wow. And, of course, last year I watched The Lost Boys. For the first time. Those are just some of the ones that come to mind here. But how real is what's being portrayed in those films and in some of the television shows that are out there that I haven't mentioned to reality? I mean, there is so much more to vampirism, and we're going to learn that tonight together. A bit of a history lesson here to get us started. All the way back in the 1720s. So we're going back 300 years. And that's what's so fascinating. Here we are, 2020, and vampirism, at least the first accounts that I know of, were in the 1720s. So 300 years ago. Is this something that is still happening today? Well, I don't know the answer to that question. We'll have to ask my guest tonight. But it was in London in the 1720s when the stink, the smell of decomposing flesh, decomposing bodies, was distracting churchgoers. Some had even claimed that the noxious vapors were causing them disease. Locals even on the other side of Europe also blamed corpses for spreading disease. And then there's this story in the village of Kiziljevo. I probably butchered that, but you never know. Kiziljevo. Villagers there believed that a Serbian peasant became a vampire after he died and killed fellow villagers post-mortem. Now, this may be more than just legend, because the widow of Petar Blagojevich claimed that he knocked on her door after the funeral and, you know, seemingly was supposed to be in the ground and dead at that point, and here he was on the doorstep in a very aggressive manner, demanding his shoes, and reports are that he tried to strangle his widow. And then villagers say that over the coming nights, he attacked 9 more villagers and killed them. Elders determined that Blagojevich was a vampire, V-A-M-P-Y-R-I. That is the official spelling, V-A-M-P-Y-R-I. It is a Serbian word, which means back from the dead. Now, his body was exhumed at that point. They had, you know, a fair amount of suspicion to believe that he, yes, was a vampire. And if he was, he should be punished for his sins. Well, in order to do this, they had to dig up the body, right? They had to have some sort of evidence to go off of. So here they are. They exhume the body, and they go on with an autopsy. And the examiner found that the blood in the body was fresh, particularly around the mouth, which would indicate that he had been active in sucking blood from victims, which is, you know, one of those traits that goes along with vampires. Now, the corpse also appeared and smelled fresh. It was not decaying. It didn't smell like it was decaying, as a dead body would, which indicated that it had been active, likely in the dead of night, right? The dead of night. So we've got fresh blood, we've got fresh appearance, fresh smell, not decaying yet, supposedly or supposed to be dead. Well, at that point, the fate was sealed for Blagojevich. It was at that point that the locals drove a sharp stake through his gut. And at that point, fresh blood just began to gush from the ears and from the mouth, which was further proof of the undead. Because if you've been buried and you're dead, blood is not actively gushing through your system. And if they drive a stake through you and blood begins to flow, well, it proves that you weren't actually dead. This was a big deal 300 years ago. There was an official report that went viral, but of course, before viral was a thing. The first printing of the term, again, that Serbian term for back from the dead, vampire, a V-A-M-P-Y-R-I, or vampire, appeared at that point in a sensational newspaper story, and it went around the world. At the end of the 17th century, there was a problem with graveyards being full to the brim. I mean, they were stuffed so full, there was literally nowhere else for you to stack a dead body. And so they had to start stacking them up, literally layer upon layer. I know that's just an awful thought. And so you've got rotting flesh and bones upon rotting flesh and bones upon another layer. And all it takes is just a heavy rainstorm or something like that to come in, and here the dead are rising again. In fact, now that I think about it, a night like tonight, late October, a night like tonight, 1 week from All Hallows Eve, in which there could be a rainstorm that could cause some of the dead to rise. And thus the legend of vampires began, supposedly. Tonight we're going to unearth the bloody dirt, so to speak, about the mystical creature who seemingly lurk in the dead of night. My guest tonight is A.P. Sylvia, who has long been interested in supernatural beliefs and their origins. He's explored the essential texts of vampire folklore and has visited various vampire-related locations. He runs the blog locationsoflore.com and is author of the book Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. It's good to have you here on the program. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm well, thanks. Thank you for having me.
So was my analysis of the history of, you know, at least how the vampire story came to be, because it's been about, you know, 300 years or so from what I've been able to gather that, you know, the vampire legend has existed.
Well, you know, the story you mentioned of Peter Blagojevich is a very much a well-known account. As you said, it went viral as in the way that things could back in the, you know, 1700s, which was a lot of newspaper reports and stuff like that. But there are actually accounts that I would deem to be vampire accounts that actually predate that one.
By how much?
One of the earliest accounts that I ran across that, again, I would say would be a vampire account because it contains a lot of these essential elements, was written about in the 12th century by an English chronicler, William of Newburgh. And he was writing about an event that happened at a location called Anatus Castle, which was either in Northern England or Scotland, not exactly clear, but in Great Britain. So already there's an account here that's sort of outside sort of the time and place that that people think of. And I can share that story with you if you're interested.
I would be interested. Yeah, AP, go ahead.
The most important back-to-school essential for your college girl is the one no one's talking about. And right now, at She's Birdie, it's buy two, get one free. The packing lists are full of shower caddies and mattress toppers, but they leave off the one thing built to help her stay safe walking across campus after dark. It's Birdie 3.0, a rechargeable personal safety alarm small enough to live on her keychain or backpack and cute enough to carry anywhere. One pull of the top pin activates a 130-decibel siren that brings all eyes on her. No aiming, no buttons, no training. Just one instinctive pull, even with shaking hands. A dedicated on-off switch means it's always ready, but never going off between classes. Head to shesbirdie.com and stock up for everyone heading back to school with our limited-time buy two, get one free sale. That's shesbirdie.com. This episode sponsored by She's Birdie. You lock the hotel room door, then check it again, and maybe one more time, because even the nicest room can feel unfamiliar at night. That's why She's Birdie created Birdie Box. With She's Birdie, you can bring peace of mind with you. Birdie Box is a portable travel door alarm for hotels, dorms, Airbnbs, and anywhere you stay away from home. Just attach it to the doorframe, switch it on, and if someone opens the door, Birdie Box blasts a loud siren and flashing alarm to alert you and everyone nearby. Because the best part of travel isn't worrying, it's sleeping soundly. Birdie Box from She's Birdie. Locking in peace of mind wherever you stay. For safer, more confident travel, visit shesbirdie.com. That's shesbirdie.com.
Sure. Essentially, what happens in this story is that there's a man that lives in the village who is considered to be kind of a scoundrel, sort of an evil character. And he suspects that his wife is having an affair. So to kind of prove it out, to catch his wife, he hatches a scheme. He tells her that he's going to be going away for a while. But instead of leaving, he hides in the rafters of his house to sort of spy on her and catch her in the act. But while hiding up there, he loses his grip, he falls, and he injures himself hitting the floor. So his wife finds him, and they take him to bed, and he's sort of severely injured, not doing well. They ask him if he wants the last rites, but he refuses, and he subsequently dies. So in this account, you actually have a number of different elements that sort of would lead people to believe that this person would become a vampire. In our modern notions about vampires, you know, in like movies and stuff like that, you normally need a vampire to become a vampire, right? You like get bitten by one or something like that. But in folklore, there was a bunch, there was like a laundry list of causes that could result in someone becoming a vampire. So in this case, we had someone who was evil in life. He died an unnatural death. Oftentimes suicides were thought to become vampires. This guy didn't commit suicide, but he died sort of kind of by his own hand in a way, sort of unnaturally. And he died in a state of sin, right? He refused the last rites. So there you have a bunch of elements that are like, you know, it's sort of this gonna lead to vampirism, right? He's checked a number of boxes here. And according to the tale, that is what happens. His corpse rises from the grave at night and walks through the streets of the village, kind of pursued by this pack of dogs. So people in the village start staying indoors during the night to avoid the attacks of this undead man. But what happens is that his breath poisons the air of the village and causes a plague. So this illness descends upon the populace, and people start dying. So apparently it kind of goes through the village. Many people pass away. A lot of people flee the village in fear. And so ultimately there's sort of just a small remnants of the population that's left. The remaining people decide to kind of have a meeting and sort of discuss what to do. But these two brothers decide that they're going to take matters into their own hands. They say to themselves, you know, they had already lost their father to the illness, and they figured that they were going to die unless they did something. So they go, they dig up the corpse of this man, and they dig him up, and he kind of has this bloated look about him. When they pierce his body, blood comes out, and the story kind of describes it's as if he was like a bloated leech full of the blood of many people. And actually, in the Latin version of this tale, the word they use is sanguisuga, which translates to leech, but quite literally, sanguisuga translates to bloodsucker. So they take the body, they pull out the heart, and they burn the corpse. And this destroys the undead man. And I guess the flames kind of have this sort of purifying effect on the air, and the plague ceases. So these two brothers end up saving their village from this revenant. So to me, that story, which again dates from the 12th century, has a lot of the different components that especially in folklore, would be kind of associated with vampires, although they didn't use the term vampire in that place and time.
And so if the dead had bitten someone, theoretically, the plague could have continued and they would have had to have, killed again.
Yeah, so in folklore, vampires certainly could cause other vampires. There are accounts where people who when it was believed that they had been tormented by a vampire in life, they were susceptible to becoming a vampire themselves in death. There's actually an account from the 1700s where this village experienced these sort of two bouts of vampirism. One from a man who himself had been terrorized by a vampire in life, but then later on from somebody else who had, I think they had eaten the meat of an animal that the vampire had feasted on. And so then this person was believed to have become a vampire as well. But it's interesting to note that the person would become a vampire after they eventually died of whatever happened to sort of eventually kill them, right? So it's not like they would, you know, if someone was terrorized by a vampire, but they lived, they say survived this plague or whatever, they could become a vampire when they ultimately died of old age or accident or something like that. It was sort of something that kind of stayed.
This episode sponsored by She's Birdie. You know that little wave of relief when someone texts, "Made it home safe"? That's exactly the feeling She's Birdie was designed for. The Birdie Disc is a clip-on personal safety light and alarm made for everyday moments where visibility and attention matter most. Night walks, early morning runs, parking garages, college campuses, dog walks, travel. It features bright flashing LED light modes, a built-in flashlight, and a 130 decibel siren that can quickly draw attention if something feels wrong. And because it's lightweight, rechargeable, TSA-friendly, and easy to clip onto jackets, bags, strollers, bikes, or keychains, it actually fits into real life without being bulky or complicated. More than 4 million people already trust She's Birdie for added peace of mind. For the people you care most about, daughter, partner, friend, student, or parent, this is one of those simple things that can make a real difference. Go to she'sbirdie.com. Again, that's she'sbirdie.com.
And then made them susceptible after death in the future.
So when somebody says, are vampires real or fairy tale, what do you tell them?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a big world out there. And certainly I know vampires or vampiric-like entities do are considered to exist in certain spiritual beliefs and stuff like that. Me personally, having read the accounts of vampires, I'm not yet convinced that there are physical corpses rising out of the ground. But I do believe that the people who experienced these things truly did feel that this was in fact occurring, that they were experiencing this kind of supernatural phenomena of, a vampire, a revenant, the undead coming to them and causing harm.
Very interesting. So I appreciate you you clarifying that for us. So what prompted your fascination with this?
So for me, I've always been interested in sort of the supernatural beliefs and the paranormal and things like that sort of throughout my life, ever since I was a child. So, you know, I've read books about things and watched documentaries and stuff like that. But for me, what got me interested on vampires specifically was a trip I took to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, the one in Times Square in New York City. I don't know if you've ever been to one, but they're really fun. There's lots of different sort of cool artifacts and objects and things like that. And so while I was there, one of the objects they had on display was this sort of antique looking box filled with different bottles and vials, and it was like a stake and a mold for silver bullets and stuff like that. And it was labeled as a 19th century vampire killing kit. And supposedly people bought these kits and took them, when they went to Eastern Europe and stuff like that. And the visual of this kit was really striking. It was a great piece, had a lot of impact. And so after that visit, I sort of kept thinking about this kit, and I was like, well, what's the story behind this thing? I wanted to learn more. So I took to the internet and started looking into it. And I found out there was actually some controversy surrounding them. While Ripley's has a number of kits on display in their different locations, they maintain that they are authentic pieces. Other people argue that they are in fact 20th century constructions using period pieces. One of the arguments that was kind of made for it was that, well, this kind of reflects sort of the film versions of vampires and stuff like that, and doesn't really reflect, you know, the actual folklore.
Vampires of Lore, our program tonight. My guest is A.P. Sylvia. I'm Jeremy Scott from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest.
We're streaming 24/7 on the Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live and at ParanormalRadio.com.
Abnormal News. I'm Brad Bernard.
Orex had descended below the
the 5-meter mark. The hazard map is go for tag. Contact expected in 50 seconds.
We're going in.
Touchdown declared.
NASA made history Tuesday after a spacecraft successfully collected samples from the surface of an asteroid during a carefully orchestrated hours-long maneuver in orbit, according to reporting by NBC News. Here's Dante Loretta, principal investigator of the OSIRIS-REx mission and professor of planetary science and cosmochemistry at the University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory.
The spacecraft did everything it was supposed to do, so we did it. We tagged the surface of the asteroid, and it's up to Bennu now to see how the event went.
NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft used its robotic arm to gather pieces of the space rock that will subsequently be sent to Earth for study. The event marks an important milestone for NASA. It's the first time the agency has gathered samples from an asteroid in space. 10 newly discovered asteroids with a close approach within one lunar distance were discovered from October 12th through the 18th, marking a significant increase in detection and flybys of asteroids within one lunar distance in such a short period of time. That's according to a report in The Watchers. 9 newly discovered asteroid flybys were detected from October 15th to the 18th. There are now 84 known asteroids to fly by Earth within one lunar distance since the start of the year. 2020 now has surpassed 2019 by 7 less than one lunar distance asteroids and holds the record for the closest asteroid flyby. You can read more about tonight's news at parabnormalradio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News.
This is Dracula, the original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived after death, lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Weird again, one show at a time. You're traveling into the paranormal. Jeremy Scott.
Our program tonight is called Vampires of Lore, and my guest is AP Sylvia, and he was talking just before the break with us about some of the differences, particularly those portrayed in films, some that I have mentioned, some that I have not mentioned, and actual folklore. So now that we have a bunch of time to get into this, please continue, AP.
Sure. So, you know, the question of sort of what did people really believe about vampires versus, you know, kind of what do we think of for movies and pop culture and stuff like that? That was really the kind of the question that was in my mind, you know, because I knew there were some differences just from like documentaries I had watched and things like that. So I kind of set out to sort of find, I wanted like a list, like a complete breakdown, like take everything that we think about vampires and tell me where it came from. Was it truly from folklore? Was it introduced through fiction or movies or something? Where is it all from? And I couldn't really find a comprehensive list like that, like what I wanted. So I started doing research and I ended up kind of writing the book that I wanted to read. And that's how I arrived at Vampires of Lore.
Yeah. And so the premise of the book is what, AP?
Well, basically, it's a trait-by-trait breakdown of all of our common notions about vampires. So each chapter focuses on a certain vampire trait, you know, fangs, garlic, coffins, stakes, all that. And for each one, I sort of examine, are there any folkloric precedents for it? or, you know, legends or what have you. If there are, I'll kind of share those and sort of talk about kind of where, you know, what the beliefs were. And if there aren't, then I try to determine, well, when did this get introduced? Is this a product of literature? Did this come from the movies or what have you? So with each chapter, I take that on with each trait. And I think as the book sort of progresses, I sort of strip away all of our modern notions and understandings of what a vampire is to reveal sort of the true folkloric vampire beneath. And I think, you know, by the end, you have sort of a fuller sense of what people actually believed and then how it evolved over time to arrive at, you know, the Count Dracula we see in Halloween decorations.
So how do we define what is a vampire, what is not a vampire? Because it's more than just dressing up like one and engaging in the behavior. So how do we define this? And, you know, because a lot of people may just be into that type of thing, but they may not actually be a vampire, you know?
Sure. Yeah. There are people who, you know, do enjoy the kind of the, you know, like a sort of a goth, you know, the gothic aesthetic, and they'll dress that way and stuff like that. So when you start looking at kind of folklore and legends, there's a lot of different supernatural beliefs that might have vampire-like creatures, right? And it can get pretty broad. So when I started looking at all of these different stories, I realized pretty quickly that I need to kind of hone in on how do I define a vampire? You know, for the purposes of this book, for the purposes of figuring out kind of what the beliefs were. Because otherwise I feel like it gets very muddied, because you get all these other sort of creatures that maybe don't really, they don't really resonate with maybe the psychological core of where vampire beliefs came from. So for me, I came up with sort of three criteria that I use personally to define what a vampire is. Other authors might cast a wider net than me. Others might cast a more narrower net. But this, I felt, for me at least, in my research, kind of reflected what was sort of most apt. So the first criteria is that the vampire is the corpse of a once living person, right? So there are beliefs about sort of demons and monsters and supernatural creatures and stuff like that, that maybe they drink blood or whatever, but they were never human to begin with, right? So to me, an important aspect of vampires is that they were once living people. They were once normal people. They were friends. They were neighbors, and they have since passed away. I felt that you know, the inclusion of non-human entities that were never human, again, sort of muddied the water. My second criteria was that the corpse is harming the living in some way. So I actually have a bit of a broader view than just the blood sucking. It gets more to the core of the fear of the dead and the harm that they pose to the living, right? Even in the Peter Plagojewitz story, right? The people were saying that he was strangling them in the night. He was lying on top of them and strangling them. The blood sucking only gets mentioned once they actually exhume the corpse and they see blood around the mouth. The last criteria was that to destroy the vampire, action has to be taken against the corpse itself. So this gets to the physicality of the vampire. Vampires aren't these kind of detached entities, ghosts or, you know, spirits or whatever. They're a physical threat. And there's a physical root to the problem that, you know, sort of the village is experiencing. And it's buried in the cemetery somewhere. And if they can take action against it, they can solve what they believe they can solve this problem. So those are my three criteria.
Okay, that's important. So what kinds of sources and research do you use in trying to dig into some of this folklore and some of these you know, traits and as you say, modern misconceptions?
Yeah, so one thing I found when I kind of first started doing research is if you start reading, kind of maybe you read a quick article online about vampire folklore or something like that. Oftentimes, people can either knowingly or not be influenced by their preconceived notions about what vampires are. So the story may get framed in a way that kind of includes some of our modern tropes. But then when you go back to an earlier story, the earlier account of the same story, suddenly some of those things might not be there anymore. And it's a bit different. So for me, I tried to go back to sources that were from, you know, the 1800s, the 1700s. I would sometimes use modern sources, but when I did, I tried to be kind of judicious in which ones I picked. I tried to pick ones that, you know, were a bit more scholarly in nature. It had sources and citations and stuff like that. So I kind of knew where stuff was coming from, because sometimes you might read something, you know, you might read a quick article or something like that, and it doesn't say where any of this is. Just like, oh, people believed this. And it's like, well, where did you get that? Where is that coming from? So I thought it was important to try to go back in time as much as I could. And if I wasn't going back in time, to try to pick sources that were, you know, a bit more scholarly, in nature whenever possible. And I mean, I wound up with, I think I have like over 90 sources in my bibliography in the book. And everything I say in the book, when I talk about any kind of vampire belief or something like that, I always include citations of where I got it from. So, you know, if I say, well, these people, you know, believed this about vampires, there's a footnote or an endnote that says it came from this source. So anyone who wants to learn more, who wants to explore things in more detail, I've given the mechanism to do that. So you don't necessarily sort of like need to take my word for it that this was a belief out there somewhere. I'm saying where I get everything.
Are vampires among us?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean. There are certainly folks who identify with vampires and believe themselves to be vampires in some way. There are some folks that think that they need to sort of consume small amounts of blood from kind of willing participants to sort of feel normal or what have you. There are some people that feel they're psychic vampires. That's not necessarily like, that's not really the nature of my research. So I really haven't talked to those folks personally, so I can't speak too much about that, but it certainly does come up. There are people, you know, to this day that believe that vampires in sort of the folkloric sense are real. One of the accounts I mentioned briefly in my book actually happened in the 2000s. There was a remote village in Romania that believed that a recently deceased person was a vampire, and they ended up exhuming the corpse and taking action against it. And the account kind of made it into the international press and stuff like that. So the folkloric or the supernatural beliefs of vampires actually are still out there, maybe in some small pockets. So there are some folks that would say, yes, there are vampires.
I'm guessing, though, doing that these days wouldn't go over so well.
Well, no. I mean, I think, well, in the incident in Romania in the 2000s, I think the police were called in and stuff. But I mean, when you look back, especially at some of the old accounts from, say, the 1800s or 1700s, these were people who were very much in the grip of fear, and they didn't have the benefit of sort of the knowledge that we have today about disease, about the decomposition process and stuff like that. So it was a group of people trying to make sense of their world, and that's how they did it. Obviously, these days we have the benefit of all this, so the vampire has kind of shifted from being this creature that people were quite scared of in the real world, so shifting to something that lives in our imagination, right? In films and books and stuff. And it resonates with us, but it resonates with us now in a different way.
Would it surprise you if there were blood-sucking rituals that were going on today?
Well, you know, like I said before, it's a big world. So a lot of people get up to a lot of things, so I really never know what to expect.
Okay. Because it wouldn't shock me. In fact, it might explain it might explain a few things, actually. All right. So what's one trait of being a vampire that we would probably be surprised to learn isn't present in folklore?
Sure. So this one, I always feel kind of sad saying this, and I feel like I'm kind of raining on people's parades a bit. Probably one of the most iconic things that, you know, pieces of imagery that we think of with vampires are fangs, right? When you're watching a movie or something like that, and like, you know, this kind of character looks menacingly at the camera and then, you know, smiles and they've got the two canines, right? The two fangs. You kind of immediately know, oh, that's a vampire, right? Like that's really all the show needs to do to communicate that to the audience, that this is a vampire. They have extended canines. So it probably comes as a surprise to most people to learn that in folklore, vampires did not have fangs. It was never mentioned. None of the accounts talk about vampires having fangs. The whole notion of the two fang marks in the neck, not present in folklore. In my research at best, there was a belief, there was one belief that vampires had like a barb on the end of their tongue, kind of like a stinger kind of thing. There were a few references to vampires having elongated teeth, but it doesn't say fangs. It doesn't say canines. It just says that their teeth, were longer. You might interpret that as people misunderstanding sort of the decomposition process with receding gums or something like that. But the whole notion of the two fangs is not present. When a wound from a vampire is discussed, there were some accounts where there was a wound on the neck, but it's a singular wound. It's not like two puncture marks or something like that. Where the fangs got introduced was actually in the 19th century. There was a penny dreadful in the 1840s called Varney the Vampire. And so it would kind of, you know, it was a serial, so it came out like, you know, in little pieces over time. And it was very long running. It ended up getting assembled into a novel that was like 800 pages or something like that. And it follows the exploits of this vampire named Sir Francis Varney. And in Varney the Vampire, the main character there, it does say that he has fangs. Mentions tusk-like teeth at one point, and it mentions the two marks in the victim's neck. And so that's actually where it got introduced. So, you know, for us, it's a given that a vampire has fangs, and the two marks are, you know, the indication that someone's a victim of a vampire or whatever. But you can kind of imagine how sort of novel that would have been for the Victorian readers going through this and kind of seeing this imagery or reading this imagery for the first time.
Interesting. So how was the blood sucking done without fangs?
Well, it's interesting. I think it depends on the story, depends on the account. I think in some accounts, like the Peter Blagojevich account, it's really never explained, right? They see the blood on the mouth. They know people were getting ill, they were dying, and they basically put two and two together, right? Blood around the mouth can be a natural part of the decomposition process. Fluids can come out through the mouth. So I think in some cases, people saw that, and they kind of just said, oh, that it must have been drinking the blood, even though there wasn't necessarily any mark on the victim or something like that. I think, getting back to like the barb on the tongue, that would have been a way that the vampire would have done it. There was actually one account that mentions this vampire that kind of it invades someone's home. There's two people sleeping, and the vampire actually takes a bucket and strikes one of the sleeping people on their back and creates this wound that blood flows out. And the vampire actually collects the blood in the bucket and then drinks it, which is kind of an interesting, very interesting account. So I think it kind of varied depending on the place. There were beliefs that, you know, the wound would be around on the chest, like over the heart or something like that. So the vampire would have been sort of attacking or maybe chewing, on the chest to get at the heart and thus the source of the blood. I think it was, you know, like a lot of folkloric beliefs, there's sort of shifts in evolution depending on the place and the time and how people were interpreting things. So, but unfortunately, none of them seem to ever have the two canines that we kind of are so accustomed to.
There's got to be many more things that have been misconstrued over time as well.
Oh, absolutely. There's one, I think, another sort of powerful piece of Halloween imagery, right, are the bats, right? Are vampires turning into bats? That's often, that's used to great effect in some movies.
Well,
the
Dracula movie, 1931. Sure. That was 90 years ago that myth, if it is a myth, has been circulated.
Oh yeah, so I mean, it works well in the movies. It's present in Bram Stoker's novel, where this bat is seen, flying outside the character Lucy's window, because the vampire, the count, was feeding on her every night. I think the whole notion of the bat kind of resonates with us, like, oh, it's a nighttime creature. We know there were vampire bats, right? So there are there are bats that drink blood. So obviously there's got to be a connection there. And you'd think there would be a really strong folkloric connection to bats. It just seems to make sense. So that was actually something that I was surprised by. For a very long time, it was actually believed that Stoker invented the notion of a vampire turning into a bat. They thought it was sort of a product of Stoker's novel that we have this bat vampire association. In my research, I ran across this one scholarly article that found a couple literary references that predated Stoker, and found two references to vampires turning into bats, but that's about it. Essentially, vampires turning into bats is virtually unknown in folklore, aside from maybe like these two quick references that were found. It wasn't a thing in folklore for some reason. Vampires turned into a lot of other animals in folklore. There's kind of some of them have like laundry lists of vampires turning into all kinds of animals, but bats are practically non-existent, which is so surprising. It's probably important to note in all this that because people often think, well, the vampire bat, that must have sort of informed vampire beliefs, right? But the thing is that the vampire bat is only native to the Americas. So Europeans, wouldn't have known about them prior to the 1500s is when Europeans sort of first encountered the vampire bat. And then you kind of have to wonder, well, how long did it take to sort of disseminate that information? And the vampire bat, the vampire in the name, they were named for the monster, not like the other way around or something like that. So I think that's another one that's I think kind of surprising, that, the folklore associated with bats is so limited. Really, we have to thank Stoker for our kind of our bat associations. It was in Dracula, and so if he ultimately was the major popularizer, if not the inventor, of this notion that a vampire can turn into a bat. So I always think that's another one that's surprising, because that's such another sort of powerful image for us, especially like Halloween and stuff like that. You got bats flying all over the place.
Yeah, we do certainly hear about that a lot. And so my guest tonight is AP Sylvia. Our program tonight is called Vampires of Lore, and I'm Jeremy Scott. From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, we'll be right back.
Stream us on your favorite apps from anywhere in the world, anytime, day or night. Into the Paranormal with Jeremy Scott. pushing the envelope and never looking back. You're traveling into the paranormal.
Seven nights away from All Hallows Eve, and we're talking about vampires of lore tonight with my guest, A.P. Sylvia, and he is author of the book Vampires of Lore, Traits in Modern Misconceptions. His website is locationsoflore.com. He's visited quite a few locations with vampiric and other history. He was talking right before the break about vampires not necessarily turning into bats as much as at least turning into other animals. Like what, AP?
Well, dogs are one that comes up quite a bit. And so I think that that probably is a bit more in line with some of our thinking, like in Dracula with the vampire turning into, Dracula turning into a wolf and that kind of thing. But some of the animals are kind of unexpected. I think there's one where the vampire turns into like a giant hen or something like that, that attacks somebody. So it was sort of, an interesting mix of different, of something you might expect that sort of makes sense. And also things that probably don't quite fit. But, again, it all depends on, you know, sort of the nature of folklore and, how these sort of beliefs would shift from place to place and kind of time to time. I mean, blood-sucking insects, people believe that a vampire could turn into. I suppose that kind of makes sense, though. I don't necessarily think of Dracula turning into a mosquito, right? And then he might get squished or something like that.
Go ahead. That would make more sense, a blood-sucking vampiric mosquito.
Yeah, I mean, it works. It works for
it
sure.
Does, yeah.
So yeah, you never know. I mean, one of them mentions a goat, turns into a goat. Like, okay, why not? But I think it was probably all informed by different scenarios that maybe took place where someone thought they were being attacked by a vampire, and this is just my conjecture. They thought some sort of vampiric incident was going on, and perhaps they saw some kind of animal around and then put, you know, two and two together. It's like, oh, that animal, that goat walking by, that must have been the vampire. That's kind of what my hunch is to maybe how some of these things showed up.
Gotcha. Okay. So are those basically the traits that you think are the most important people know aren't actually a part of folklore, when vampiric folklore, or there more?
I mean, in my research, I found there are traits that, you know, aren't present in folklore. There are traits that are present, maybe to a limited extent, or sometimes even if they are present, there's kind of nuance to them that maybe has been lost over time with sort of the vampire's jump to pop culture. I think the fangs and the bats are probably one of the biggest ones. I mean, even like we were talking about blood drinking earlier, right? Like, you know, vampires are always drinking blood in our sort of fiction and all that. But when you look at the accounts, yes, blood drinking is present, but it's not necessarily, sometimes it's not present, it's something else, or sometimes it's kind of mentioned after the fact. Again, like in the Plagojewicz account, right, where, oh, he was strangling, he was lying on top of people and strangling them. And then they talk about the blood drinking when they exhumed the corpse, which, you know, we don't think of vampires like strangling people in movies and stuff like that. That's not really kind of their deal. But, you know, I think it was in the beliefs, you know, in sort of the different sort of beliefs, vampires were probably sort of thought to do all kinds of different things. So I found it interesting, sort of the evolution and the nuance, where even if I did find something that was that matched what our pop culture had, there might be sort of extra information or some kind of surprise lurking.
Gotcha. So is it true that villagers used wooden stakes and other objects like, you know, the garlic and mirrors and things like that?
Sure. So there's a bit to unpack with each one of those. For wooden stakes, yes, absolutely. Wooden stakes were present in folklore, were used in various accounts. like in the Plagojevitz account, a stake was used. But I think it's important to sort of note that in movies and stuff like that, usually it's like a wooden stake through the heart, and oftentimes there's almost like maybe a magical connotation or something where like the vampire could be lunging at someone and they stake them and then the vampire is dead. In folklore, there are a few different kind of beliefs surrounding staking. First of all, depending on the place, the type of wood used was important. It could, again, depending on the place, it could be hawthorn, it could be blackthorn, it could be oak. But there were beliefs that you had to use a specific kind of wood for your stake in order for it to be effective. Oftentimes it was believed that the wood in question was thought to have been involved with the crucifixion. So there were religious connotations to the type of wood being used. Also in some of these accounts, when they talk about staking the vampire, they talk about driving the stake through the vampire to pin them to the ground, to pin them to the earth. So in these cases, it was actually that the stake was holding the vampire down in its grave and sort of preventing it from sitting up and getting out. So there's actually kind of like a practical sort of interpretation of why the stake was effective, right? It was actually physically stopping the corpse from walking around. However, you know, driving it through the heart, the destruction of the heart, there were also beliefs that involved removing the heart, destroying the heart, that kind of thing. So I think there was kind of, depending on the place, sort of a dual, there could be kind of a dual interpretation there of, you know, destroying the heart, which again is an organ associated with blood and stuff like that. So staking was present, but again, there's nuances there that maybe have been sort of lost over time with the vampire's jump to kind of the big screen or something like that. With garlic, that's another one that is in folklore for sure. That one's very much present. It was people would take garlic, they might rub it, around like their doors and keyholes and entrances to their house and stuff like that to sort of keep vampires away. With mirrors. The mirror is actually another one that we can thank Stoker for. So, you know, in the movies, right, the vampire doesn't cast a reflection. This was not a belief in folklore, and to a certain extent, it's not surprising. I mean, you know, if you look at the accounts, they were literally exhuming bodies. Like they could have taken a mirror and held it up to the body, and they would have seen a reflection. So it's not necessarily that surprising that mirrors weren't utilized in that way. There actually were beliefs where if a dead body was reflected in a mirror, that could cause a vampire. That the dead person might actually become a vampire because they were reflected in the mirror. I think that probably relates to sort of the beliefs involving mirrors reflecting the soul and stuff like that. You know, there are also beliefs where, you know, if there was a death, you should cover up the mirrors because, you know, having the mirrors sort of open might make other people vulnerable to die because the souls are reflected and the dead soul might, you know, sort of take somebody or something like that. So there are certainly connotations with mirrors and the soul, but, Not with the vampires casting the reflection. Interestingly, in Stoker's notes that he wrote while authoring Dracula, he had actually planned also for the count to the count wouldn't be able to be photographed, wouldn't be able to be painted, as in like in a portrait. So like Stoker had envisioned it so that Dracula wouldn't, there could be no sort of sort of representation of Dracula or a recording of Dracula or something like that. But I think what Stoker, likely what Stoker was going for with the lack of the reflection, again, with the connotations of mirrors in the soul, you know, the beliefs that the mirror sort of reflects the soul and stuff like that. So to have his villain, to have Count Dracula not cast a reflection in the mirror, I think, you know, it's possible Stoker was trying to convey that Dracula had no soul. he was sort of this a soulless being, this animated body, and that's why there was no reflection, because there was no soul to cast back. And so I like the whole mirror reflecting thing, because it's this nice kind of evolution of the mirror and vampires and souls and all that, how it's present in folklore in different ways, and then sort of Stoker takes it and goes another step with it and adapts it and kind of sends a message with it at the same time. So I find that one particularly fascinating.
What about vampires hypnotizing their victims?
Yeah, so that I was looking for that one. I found a single account where there was a vampire. It was the vampire of a dead warlock, and he comes back from he comes back as a vampire, and he's terrorizing this town, and he meets up with this this soldier. And he accompanies this soldier into town, and they essentially crash a wedding. And the vampire's, I guess, having a good time at the wedding, and then decides he's not having a good time at the wedding and scares everyone away. And then he puts the bride and the groom into like a state of sleep. He puts them to sleep and then takes blood from them, puts the blood in vials, I believe, and then leaves. So that was kind of the one account where I could say, well, like, you know, sort of putting people to sleep is kind of like a hypnotism sort of thing, right? Maybe, you know, like when you think of like a hypnotic trance or something. But you also have to take into account that in this tale, the vampire was also a warlock. So he would have had, you know, he would have had magical powers. So it might have been that the putting people to sleep was a product of his magical abilities, and not necessarily because he was a vampire. But that was kind of the one sort of hypnosis incident I found in folklore. I think, you know, obviously it's the notion of vampires kind of, you know, fascinating their victims and sort of putting them in trance or whatever, like, came about with the 19th century literature and stuff like that. I think probably because it probably resonated with Victorian readers, because there was an interest in hypnosis and mesmerism and stuff like that, I think, in the 1800s. So that probably would have kind of worked well in those stories. But that was basically what I found about the hypnosis, that it was, I found that one story. So maybe, but not really, not certainly not like a strong sort of tradition of that.
I mentioned earlier in that report, the story that I talked about, that I probably butchered the hell out of the name, Mr. Blagojevich. I keep thinking of Blagojevich, our Blagojevich here in the U.S., and I think that's what got me all sidetracked there. But we talked about how some of the claims were from some of the Europeaners there back, you know, 300 years ago, that these corpses, having them around, the stench, those noxious vapors, those fumes being exposed to them, actually caused disease. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I think, you know, there was, I think with vampires, it always comes back to kind of the fear of the dead and the fear that the dead can in some way cause harm to the living. With the Plagojevich account, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing the name. I have no doubt I'm mispronouncing the name.
That makes two of us.
In that case, I believe he didn't have a smell, but that I think was a kind of a deviation. Most of the times vampires were thought to have kind of a foul smell, because they were kind of a rotting, a decomposing corpse. So they're going to smell. So I think people would interpret sort of, you know, how the vampire made people ill in different ways, right? Even like with that 12th century account with the vampire's breath causing a plague, right? I think it was people trying to make sense of the world around them, where there's something about this dead person that is a danger to us, and we need to take action against it because we're going to be harmed. You know, you're talking about sort of the smell of the vampire. That actually kind of gets me back to the garlic, right? As being this kind of defense against vampires. there's one of the theories as to why people believed that garlic was helpful was that, you know, garlic has a very strong smell, right? It's very pungent. So the smell of garlic can overpower the smell of other things. So you have kind of this practical use of garlic, right, to overpower, say, the smell of something bad, and vampires are believed to smell bad. So there was this thought that by virtue of the garlic smell overpowering the smell of vampire, sort of overcoming that, it somehow sort of magically also kept the vampire itself away because it was keeping the smell of the vampire away, which I think is kind of an interesting notion and sort of gets back to this notion, this idea of the vampire smelling bad and you're gonna smell him coming.
Well, I guess I would want to know if a vampire was coming after me, that's for sure. All right. What about sleeping in coffins? Is that something that they really do?
Yeah, they do. But again, I think there's some nuance here to explore. So with the sleeping in coffins, right? Like in the movies, right? The coffin's usually like in a dungeon or something like that, right? And you usually have like this, maybe like a nice scene where like the coffin lid slides open, maybe the hand sliding it open, the vampire kind of rises up or something like that. With the cases, you know, with the actual historical accounts, these people, the vampires were buried in the ground, right? So there was like, you know, feet of earth above them. So there was actually sort of conjecture as to how vampires were escaping their graves at night, because it's not necessarily clear how that happens. And there was actually a number of different beliefs and theories around how the vampire, which was, you know, in its coffin, buried in the ground, was sort of getting up out of it every night, but then going back to it every you know, morning. And you know, one hypothesis, there was this an abbot named Dom Augustin Calmet, and he wrote this kind of treatise on vampires and you know, supernatural things. And he wondered, you know, does the vampire does its body take on the characteristics of water such that it could move through the soil without disturbing the soil and then kind of come back, you know, sort of form itself above ground. There's another account, an old English account, where it actually says that the vampire is kind of retreating back to its grave, and the ground actually like opens up for it and then closes back up or over it, such that the guys then have to like dig it up the next morning. In some places there was a belief that if there was like a small hole by the grave, like, you know, like a hole, like, you know, a couple inches in diameter, something like that, that hole was actually how the vampire was getting out every night. It was sort of, you know, sneaking through this little hole, which that sort of a lot of these beliefs get into the nature of and the physicality of the vampire. While some would sort of have it be like this wholly physical thing, like, you know, with the ground opening up, others sort of take the vampire as being able to sort of transform itself in different ways, like being able to either sort of shrink or become almost mist-like, I guess, to move through the ground and then up and out of the grave. And then there were actually some beliefs that held that the vampire's body stayed in the ground and it kind of had like a new body or something like that, that would sort of form when its spirit kind of like rose from the ground. It would get this like new body or something. So there's a lot of different interpretations to try to explain sort of how it was that these buried people were escaping their coffins every night, and moving about, and then, you know, going back into them in the day, and you know, you're not seeing any kind of necessarily like a disturbance or something like that. So again, it's people trying to come up with how this was going on. Calmet also goes on to kind of conjecture like maybe vampires are just, you know, illusions or something like that, just the work of the devil. That you know, it's not really corpses. It's all just kind of this elaborate kind of, you know, sort of devilish hoax or something. So again, you have this. Well, maybe it's this. Maybe it's that. But I think probably what's most striking is that, you know, they were in coffins, and they were people that the villagers knew. You know, they were friends. They were neighbors that had been buried, and then, you know, people get pushed to the point that they have to, you know, they feel they need to go and exhume this person who they knew in life because they are so fearful that they themselves are going to die and join them in the cemetery.
T, on our Facebook live chat, had a question for you. Why is it necessary for people to uncover corpses to begin with, she says?
In terms of like, probably like in terms of like having to destroy the corpse, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, I think it relates to, well, there's actually some accounts where they actually didn't. I can go into those a bit too. I think a lot of it was catharsis that people were, you can imagine sort of the state of mind people were in, that drove them to think that someone who was dead and buried was causing them harm. So you can imagine the fear and maybe the hysteria that had gripped a town or a village. So they needed an outlet for that. So digging up the corpse, destroying, mutilating the corpse in some way, I think provided a catharsis to people allowed them to vent all of these fears. Because oftentimes when these things are happening, there's unexplained deaths going on in the community and stuff like that. You know, one person dies, another person dies, another person dies. And, these are people that maybe they were young and healthy and suddenly they get sick and pass away in a short period of time. So there's this fear that's kind of creeping around that, well, who's next?
All right, hold that thought. AP Sylvia, my guest, our program tonight, Vampires of Lore. And I'm Jeremy Scott from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest.
Save your data and listen for free by calling 701-719-9703, courtesy of TalkStream Live. Abnormal News, I'm Brad Bernards. Cosmonauts are making progress in the fight against the small air leak that has beleaguered the International Space Station for months, according to Russian reports. Kenny Todd, NASA Deputy Manager for the International Space Station.
This little atmosphere leak that's proven to be a bit challenging over the last couple of months. We saw a little bump up in it here a couple of months ago. We did some isolation testing on orbit to try to find the source of the leak. We got a lot of good data out of that, and we were still parsing through that and trying to figure out what our next steps were when we saw yet another little tick up.
Space.com reports the leak was first detected in September 2019. But was too low a priority for NASA and Roscosmos to address until August of this year.
Okay, my green hook is closed and locked. My hatch is dry.
Roscosmos cosmonaut Oleg Kononenko closing the hatch between the crew lock and equipment lock portions of the Quest.
All right, one green light. Right here.
Let me.
Looking your way.
Am I clear of the arm? Clear of the arm?
You are clear of the arm right now.
Now, cosmonauts on the space station report that they tracked down the leak October 15th and attempted to patch it, according to reports from Russia's government-owned news service, TASS. Researchers want to study every square inch of planet Earth, but not every square inch of planet Earth is easy to study. Some areas are challenging for humans to get to in order to monitor. What's the answer? According to investigators from the University of Washington, why not use flying insects, such as moths, to carry tiny, lightweight sensors weighing less than 1/100th of an ounce? It's the equivalent of a drone delivery or a military supply drop with bugs. You can read more about tonight's news at parabnormalradio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News.
I do consume human blood. I do consume human blood. Into the Paranormal, toll-free in North America at 855-790-8255. That's 855-790-TALK.
I'm Jeremy Scott with AP Sylvia, and we are talking about vampires of lore tonight. Here in our final segment with AP, if you want to join us, it's 855-790-8255, toll-free in North America. 503-506-0396 outside North America. And ITP51 on Skype. And we'll also be on tomorrow night for those who can join us at 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern. I hope you will tomorrow night. And then we're live next Saturday night for 4 hours on Halloween night. It's been a while since Halloween has actually fallen on a Saturday when we've been doing this program. In fact, I think this will be the first time this program has fallen on a Saturday. And so I'm going to spend it with you the only way I know how, and that's to do 4 hours with you next week. Talking vampires tonight with AP Sylvia, and he's author of the book Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. And right before the break, he was answering some of your questions and making the point that I guess once a vampire strikes and this starts to spread, there is this fear, AP, of, as you said, who's next?
Absolutely. And I think it sort of just grows from there. There's one person and then another, and you know, something as far as the villagers are concerned, something has to be done. So that often involves, you know, exhuming a corpse and sort of taking action against it, mutilating it in some fashion. But there are actually a couple beliefs that didn't actually involve shovel work. I mentioned earlier that sometimes there was some beliefs involve sort of a hole in the grave, like a small kind of hole in the ground next to like the headstone or something that they believed the vampire was coming through. Some of those beliefs also involved if they poured boiling water down that hole, it would actually kill the vampire. Which I think is sort of an interesting one and rather unique. But one approach that I've always kind of gotten a kick out of, because it seems like something I would come up with, was instead of digging up the vampire to stake them, what they would do is they would take essentially stakes. They were distaffs, which look like stakes. They're used for like spinning yarn. They would take these stakes and they would just drive them into the ground above where the vampire was buried, so that if the vampire tried rising from the grave, it would essentially stake itself. And I always just got a real kick out of that because it just seems like someone who just kind of wanted to get the job done and go home and maybe didn't want to have to put in a lot of time.
Let's go to Indianapolis. Hello, you're on with AP Sylvia. Who's this?
This is Susan.
Hello, Susan. So good to hear your voice.
Yes, I definitely believe that people still have odd feelings and beliefs about vampires. Case in point, several years ago, I was at a restaurant, a Steak and Shake. I don't know if you have Steak and Shakes there. And it was getting close to sunset. There was a group of four goth-dressed teenagers that were hassling people at the restaurant, and they kept walking around and like growling at them and pretending like they were vampires and stuff like that. Well, my boyfriend and I were finishing up our dinner and it just disgusted me. And I thought, what can I do to shut these kids down? Well, I noticed it was getting sunset. So I just casually walked over to the table and told them that they were a disgusting bunch of wannabes. And I started in on this little quiet tirade about how those of us that are real vampires don't appreciate the wannabes, and that if they didn't shut it down, the sun was going down and that their bodies were going to be found in the dumpster behind the restaurant, totally drained of blood. And I just quietly walked away, went back to my table and sat down. Those four kids got up, paid their bill, and left, didn't even finish their meals. So, yeah, there people still believe, and I could tell by the looks on their faces, they were gobstruck. It scared them.
You're not a vampire, Susan, are you?
No.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask.
Right, right. But no, but it sure shut them down, and everybody in the restaurant was able to eat in peace. I don't know why the waitresses and stuff didn't say something to them, but they were just being obnoxious. And apparently they believed. So they didn't even finish their dinner. They got up, paid their bills, and hauled out.
That's a good story, Susan.
I thought I would enjoy telling you that. You guys have a good evening.
You too as well.
Thank you for the show. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Our pleasure. Thank you for the call. Appreciate that. We've talked a little bit about Eastern Europe, those stories that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. What are some other places that have histories of vampires?
Yeah, well, it's spread around quite a bit. I mean, we talked earlier in the show about Great Britain with the vampire account there. There were beliefs, regarding vampire. Like entities, or as sort of as I would define them, in the Nordic countries, India, China. So it was spread around quite a bit. And in fact, maybe some people would be surprised to learn that there were beliefs about vampires, vampire incidents, as I've kind of described, that happened in the United States. In the 1700s and the 1800s, there were incidents that happened, in New England where, corpses were exhumed, in the belief that the dead were harming the living. So I think it kind of resonates with people kind of across cultures because, you know, again, it's this fear of the dead and illness and mortality are something that, you know, every society has to deal with and kind of contend with and come to terms with.
Eventually. What do you think? Do you think people of the past would recognize the vampires of today?
I think not. I think the vampire has evolved quite a bit over time. I think today, there's a lot of emphasis on vampires that are cool or suave and attractive and seductive, right? That's kind of a lot of what our pop culture vampire is now, this alluring character. In folkloric beliefs, the vampire was not alluring. You know, you didn't want to hang out with them or go on a date with them or anything like that. People were scared of vampires. They were a threat and they were frightening. People they would live in fear of, you know, the assault of a vampire. And these vampires, they were reanimated corpses. They were bloated with blood, right? There were, you know, accounts where people would, you know, open up these coffins and they would see a corpse that was kind of fat and bloated, which can happen with decomposition. And, you know, people were frightened by vampires. What happened over time is that the vampire kind of got a makeover. And that was very much in the 19th century literature. There's sort of various works that happened over time where the vampire kind of he became sort of suave or aristocratic and upper crust. Probably the work that really kind of set this in motion was a work from the 1820s. It was a novella called The Vampire. And in this work of fiction, it is about this vampire named Lord Ruthven, who has this kind of mysterious, alluring quality, and people around him are fascinated by him. But he winds up having this kind of destructive effect on the people he gets close to, and this one person kind of befriends him and travels with him and realizes ultimately that he's in fact that Lord Ruthven is a vampire. The story was written by a gentleman by the name of Polidori, who was the personal physician to Lord Byron, who was the famous poet. And when The Vampire first came out, it was falsely attributed to Lord Byron, so it gained quite a bit of publicity. Polidori and Byron didn't get along. They didn't get along well at all. So people have theorized that Polidori based Lord Ruthven, this vampire, on Lord Byron. So you have this kind of this comment, I guess, on this person he didn't like, perhaps. And so that story kind of set this trajectory with vampires suddenly being kind of having this sort of power over people, being aristocratic. I mentioned Varney the Vampire. So the novella The Vampire was like 1820. Varney the Vampire was like 1840s. That was, again, that the main character was Sir Francis Varney, who was like, you know, he's aristocratic, right? Moving all the way up to the late 1800s with Count Dracula, again, this aristocrat. So I think, you know, the vampire kind of made this jump from being this neighbor who this undead neighbor terrorizing the village to now becoming a threat to society, to high society. Now the vampire was just kind of going into people's homes at night before. Now the vampire is schmoozing at parties and stuff like that in these you know, Victorian works. And I think that's kind of what resonated with people at the time. The readers didn't necessarily need the vampire who was, you know, causing illness and death. That wasn't speaking to them. The perceived threat then became someone who could befriend you and infiltrate, you know, your parties, your families, your sort of your group, and was a threat in a different way. And so I think that, you know, sort of, you know, ultimately sort of culminates in Dracula. And then we have all the Dracula adaptations and, you know, his kind of alluring gaze and stuff. And it sort of evolves over time to you know, in different sort of movies and books, to becoming now this vampire who is seductive and attractive. And if you look at modern works of fiction and such, one of the things that really gets emphasized about vampires is their immortality. And I think that's, again, something that resonates with modern audiences, right? We don't need vampires to explain, you know, plagues and disease or famines and stuff like that, as people of the past did. But we still have a fear of death, of mortality. And so when we watch these shows, we have this creature that has sort of like circumvented mortality. They've gained immortality. But I think it speaks to us on a number of levels, because the vampire has had to pay a price for that immortality, right? They're cursed because of it, right? Now they have to feed on blood and live in the darkness and stuff like that. So they've gained immortality at a price. And, you know, sort of perhaps that sort of communicates that, you know, the natural order shouldn't be subverted. And I think that's what resonates with people today.
In the final few moments that we have with you tonight, AP Sylvia, what are some of the final statements that you would like to make?
I have to say, I think, you know, the topic of vampires is, I think, quite fascinating. I think there's a lot to dig into. And that's what I sort of found in writing my book, was that, you know, there's so much nuance and variation because we're talking about supernatural beliefs. They evolve, they grow, they change over time. What's sort of true in one place, it may not necessarily be true someplace else. There's a different interpretation. And it's interesting how vampires fit into sort of a wider supernatural world. One of my chapters, I talk about witches and werewolves with vampires, because, you know, in sort of our modern thinking, you know, vampires kind of sit in a certain box and werewolves sit in a certain box and witches. But when you actually look at folkloric beliefs, there was a lot of interplay between these different kind of supernatural beings. And you know, you could see how the beliefs in one influence beliefs in the other, and how, you know, in some places there was something called a strigoi, which was a witch in life, but then became a vampire in death. They believe that witches in life became vampires in death. So they were still strigoi either way, but some were living and some were dead. And the dead would actually sort of teach magic to the living and stuff. So there was all kinds of sort of different evolutions of these beliefs. And so there's so much there. It's a very sort of rich history. And I very much enjoyed writing the book, and it was quite the learning opportunity for me, and quite fun to dig into these tales and these legends, and to see how the vampire has grown and shifted over time, and how it turned into the vampire that, you know, kind of we all enjoy in movies and Halloween and stuff like that, and kind of gives a fresh perspective, a new perspective, or maybe a new appreciation on how the vampire has changed. You know, when I watch a vampire movie and they change something or they take liberties or whatever, and this vampire can do XYZ, I don't mind. I just see it as just a further evolution of this creature that's been shifting and evolving for hundreds of years, whether it was, you know, getting fangs or, you know, turning into bats or what have you. I think it's going to continue to sort of grow and change as time progresses. I think as things develop, maybe we'll see, you know, more vampires that are sort of based in with kind of a science fiction twist, right? Where the vampirism is due to like a virus or you know, a disease of some kind, rather than being sort of a supernatural curse. You see some shows like that. Maybe that's a direction that vampires will go in. So it's kind of interesting, and one wonders sort of how it will change, and sort of what, you know, future generations will think of when they think of a vampire.
Of all the vampire movies, which one's your favorite?
Ooh. So I have a few different favorites. You know, obviously the Universal Dracula, you know, starring Bela Lugosi is, you know, a great film, and, mm-hmm. you know, Bela's performance is just kind of, it's so powerful, and he emotes so much, you know, probably because he was, you know, did you know, theater work beforehand. A good one that, you know, maybe modern audiences might kind of need to sort of prep themselves for a little bit is Nosferatu from the 1920s, which is kind of a black and white silent film. So it's certainly kind of not up to what we're used to for production and stuff like that. So you might, you know, if you are going to watch it, maybe just sort of go in ready for it, because it's different than the medium these days. But there's some fantastic imagery in Nosferatu, really sort of just iconic. The main vampire in it, Count Orlok, he's the vampire that you've seen sort of cartoons of, where it's like he's like bald with like the pointy ears and kind of these rat like teeth and stuff like that. That's a really great film. Funny story about that film was that the production company, Prana Film, they wanted to make a Dracula movie, but they didn't get the rights. So they wound up just making the movie anyway, but changed a bunch of details. They changed the names and some of the events, hoping to kind of avoid a lawsuit. Stoker's widow, found out about the film and sued them. And the judge actually ordered that all copies of the film should be destroyed. But thankfully, a couple survived, so we still have the film today. One I really like is from the 1990s Bram Stoker's Dracula. If you've seen that one, kind of a very sort of lush interpretation, a lot of practical effects. And, you know, sometimes people will point out some of the flaws in the movie, and you know, it's not a perfect film, but there's some great parts. Anthony Hopkins plays Van Helsing. He just does an amazing job. And I think it was Gary Oldman plays Count Dracula. And that's really, you know, I thought a really sort of stellar performance. So that's another one I like. And Fright Night's a good one, too. I think you mentioned that one earlier. That one's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there was a new one that I just actually stumbled across. The trailer came out about 6 months ago. I don't know if it's been released. But what timing, considering the day and age we're in. It's a little racy. Might not be for everyone. It's called Vampire Virus. Have you heard of that one, AP?
I don't think I have.
Well, I was thinking about checking it out. I think I have to rent it. So I'm going to look into that. and I'll let my audience know. We have a question coming in through the Facebook chat. What about the servants, or as they're known, the familiars?
Yeah, I think that is very much kind of a modern introduction to vampires. It, you know, gets to like the people who are serving them and maybe hope to become, you know, immortal vampires themselves someday. In my accounts, there are some folks that were sort of like palling around with the vampire, but they were doing it sort of against their will. I mentioned the soul, like, you know, like there's one where like the soldier meets up with a vampire. There's another account where like this guy is sort of in his cart going past a graveyard, and he picks up this hitchhiker who turns out to be a vampire, and the vampire makes him like, all right, you're going to take me around the village and I'm going to go to these houses. So there are some accounts where you have these kind of like unwilling people who are, you know, maybe sort of helping out the vampire or companion to the vampire briefly. So you have those things, but they weren't like willing participants. And, you know, they ultimately wanted to get away from the vampire or destroy the vampire. Because I think it's important to note too that, you know, when you have sort of like the familiar, the someone helping the vampire, those are often the cases where like the vampire is functioning in normal society, right? Like they have maybe a house and they have, you know, they go to events in the evening. And so this person is kind of taking care of their affairs, right? Because they're a vampire and they can't, you know, go out during the day or something. In the folklore, the vampire didn't have like wasn't keeping up appearances. They were going into the cemeteries at night, and going from the cemeteries every night, and that's it. You know, they didn't have a normal life.
I appreciate you so much coming on, and what a perfect show for Seven Nights Before All Hallows Eve. AP Sylvia, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And author of course, Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. His website is locationsoflore.com. I'm Jeremy Scott from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest. Good night, everyone.